This is The Conversation. I'm Michael Shaw. It's episode 101 of The Conversation, and our guest today is Joshua Dildine. More on him in a second. Also want to tell you a little bit about my new co-host. Her name is Jen Collins, and I'm excited to have her on board. She is actually a former guest slash co-host, depending on how you frame it. She was on the episode from about a year and a half ago, little episode called The Conversation Three-Way, Episode 3. If you want to search for that episode, you can certainly do so pretty quickly through the site, theconversationpod.com. You can also just do a general web search, Jen Collins, The Conversation Podcast, and it should pop right up. So her background is both in art and therapy, and that's not to say she's an art therapist, because she's not. She is a performance artist and performer who did multiple performances with the Paul McCarthy Troupe. And more recently, and this was talked about in the podcast that with her and Julian Hober, she did a performance, therapy-related performance, in Julian's show at Blum & Poe. So if you want to hear more about that, go to that episode. But that's some pretty good credentials, great credentials for this show. And she and I together will be carefully and selectively applying analysis techniques to our guests, beginning with Joshua Dildine, who was a game first guinea pig, if you will. He was fine with it, and I appreciate his being game. And a little bit more about Joshua Dildine. He is, for those of you not familiar with him, he is an artist based in Los Angeles for about the last decade, from Fresno, California. I think this is my first Fresno originated guest. And he is an artist who paints on top of photographs. So essentially a painter, but painter slash photographer to some degree. You will hear all about that, his complicated family life and background and current family life, coming up now. Let's get to that conversation with Joshua Dildine, right now. Thank you for being here. This is The Conversation, the live in the room version, and I'm very excited to be joined back again, but this time as a co-host, Jen Collins. Hello.
Hi. Good morning.
Thank you for being with us. Excited to see what you're going to bring to this. And we are joined by our guest, Joshua Dildine.
Hello.
We say more? Welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So where do we start? You are a painter slash photographer?
Yeah.
Along those lines?
I'm still trying to figure it out. But yes, yeah.
Okay. You're still trying to figure it out. That's forthcoming. Well, we've been talking for the last 20 minutes, and now we're going to just go cold for a minute or two. Well, actually, let's start a different place. Where are you from, Joshua?
I grew up in Fresno, California, more specifically Clovis, and a smaller town. Most people hate it, and I think that's why I love it. Whenever I tell people from Southern California I'm from Fresno, I'm like, oh, the armpit of California. Is like, yes, but it's my armpit, and I love it. Yeah.
But is Clovis, like, if it can be a suburb of Fresno, is that what it is?
Yeah, yeah. A suburb, close to the mountains, and yeah.
But you're not from Fresno if you're from another town.
Yeah, I kind of overly generalize that location. Fresno is the big town that Clovis is attached to.
Right.
I lived in Fresno for a little bit, but then we moved down the street, and then it was in Clovis. So the borders are confusing.
Well, when you say you love it, is that more a nostalgic thing, or do you go back pretty regularly?
I go back. My family, my parents, aunts and uncles, grandparents, they all live there. My brothers, or one of my brothers lives there. And so I get to see my niece and nephews, which is great.
Yeah.
I love that part. I think that family connection makes it, maybe a better place. It's quieter. I live in the San Fernando Valley, and it's more chaotic. And so when I go to Fresno, I don't have to deal with traffic or anything like that. And there's the country and open space. I like that.
Right. Well, I'm glad you mentioned that you live in the Valley, because I think that's an interesting starting point as far as the breakdown of artists in Los Angeles. You know, I mean, for people not in Los Angeles, we probably would want to make clear that most artists are congregated in various neighborhoods on the east side of the city.
Mm-hmm.
You have smattering here and there on the west side, and I guess you probably have a even smaller smattering in the San Fernando Valley.
Yeah.
So you're in Reseda, which is kind of, what, north central-ish, kind of?
Yeah, it's close to Encino, Sherman Oaks, the 405.
Which are the fancier parts of the Valley.
Yeah, I'm not in the fancy part of the Valley. Yeah. I'm in the Fresno part of the Valley.
Right.
It reminds me of Fresno.
Right.
Yeah, good Mexican food everywhere. It's, you can pretty much go anywhere and get really good food.
And you chose it ultimately for practical reasons, because it's kind of equidistant from school and what else?
School, my in-laws live in Thousand Oaks, Culver City's just a couple miles that are like 20 miles, and takes a lot longer because you have to go down the 405. But yeah, we chose it because it was the more affordable, like, location in the San Fernando Valley. And they kept me close to Pepperdine is where I teach. And,
right.
And then like commuting to Culver or Santa Monica, or where most of the other artists live and work, or the east side. Mm-hmm. I used to live in Claremont for up till last year, and we moved. So that was really east side. So,
yeah, that's,
I like to keep it moving.
And were you going to grad school there?
I did. I graduated in 2010, and I loved the town. It's great. And I had a good studio out there in Upland. It was really cheap. Good community of artists out there. So it just was convenient.
So if it wasn't for Pepperdine, you might still be there.
Yeah. I commuted to from Claremont to Pepperdine for a couple of semesters, and then I had a kid, and that kind of changed it. But because I was in the car more times than I got to spend with them during the day, and I didn't like that, because I like my kids now.
Right.
Yeah.
I now have a
almost 3 month old, and a 2.5 year old. So
is the baby a girl or boy?
Two boys.
Okay.
Two boys. Yeah.
So you have your hands full for a while.
Yeah. It's been, we were talking earlier. It's, I love it and hate it, and just all the wonderful ways. I mean, I hate not getting enough sleep, but at the same time, it's kind of funny when my son comes in with a pirate patch on and his pirate sword, and he thinks our bed is like Skull Rock. And like, that's funny. Just not at 6 in the morning.
Yeah. I'm super interested to hear about how being a parent is changing your life. Not just about your commute or, you know, about school, but specifically about your work.
Yeah.
We started right off the bat. You mentioned your connection to Fresno and your family there.
Yeah.
Right. So like that's what I want to hear about.
Yeah. So I deface the family that I really talk fondly of. It's kind of a fun paradox there. It's like being a parent it's changed everything, from just being able to go out and to art openings that I used to do all the time. And then like my studio hours had to shift. I was like a night owl or I liked working midday. And so I've had to like shift that around
So what were before we get further into that, what were the circumstances that led you to say, I'm spoiling myself, I need to mix things up a little bit and have kids?
I always loved the notion of having a family of myself. I love my family, and I thought it was great. And we were thinking, we just thought it would be, we were like, okay, let's have a kid. And it was kind of simple as that. And we're like, are you ready for this long commitment? And we're like, yeah, I think it would be great. It wasn't, we've talked about it for, you know, a few years, and we kind of decided like, this is the age where we want to have a kid. And so we kind of just went for it. And then we also talked about like the spacing of kids. Right? Do we want the kids further apart? Maybe not too far apart. And then we had a kid like 2.5 years later. So yeah.
Which is about the soonest you could do it without making it too close, right?
I guess I'm 2 years from one of my brothers, and we get along great. And I was like, that's a good year. I'm with him. We were in school together, and we overlapped. And my older brother's 3 years apart, and I like that too. He was a senior when I was a freshman in high school, which, you know, it was nice to have a big brother on campus to help me with the bullies and all that stuff. And
so there's one older, one younger. Four brothers, right?
So I have one older brother, and then I have three younger brothers. And one of them lives in Chicago, one of them is living with me, and then the other one's living in Fresno. So yeah, it's a big, big family.
Wow.
Yeah. We have fun. They're all athletic, and I'm not so much. I try to be, but they're all the athletes, and I was the black sheep, and I did the whole art thing. I would go to their volleyball games or soccer games, and I would just draw on the sidelines and cheer at the same time. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you were, it sounds like you were benign black sheep because you weren't.
I was okay with it.
Harangued that much.
We're really close. We protected each other growing up. You know, one of us would get bullied, and then they'd have, the three other brothers just kind of stick up for us or stick up for me or my younger brother. Mm-hmm. It was kind of fun. It was like a little team, and yeah.
But you mentioned something about you love to also be critical of your family. Did I hear that right?
No, not critical. No, I think that it's interesting. I love acknowledging the contrast and the differences, because you know I'm an artist, but I also find that I can blend in with my other brother's interests, and that fascinates me too, because I love people. I love interacting with people, and as an artist, that gets hard at times, and so that's why I teach, and so I try to like be pretty engaged with people. And so as like my role as I would say like the peacekeeper, or I kind of play that role in my family. And so I always find ways of like engaging into whichever brother's interests. So I was talking about one of my brothers is he's a Ironman athlete, does these crazy long runs. And so I'm like attempting to pick up endurance racing, because I feel like that's a really good way for me to engage with him in conversation. And, you know, I'm an artist. He acknowledges that, and he loves the fact that I'm an artist, but like, I feel like, there's just two different wavelengths that happens. And there's when we come together with like running, I enjoy that connection. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It sounds like though I'm picking up that you're supporting your brothers, but they're not necessarily, I mean, not that they're not supporting you, but they're not necessarily getting what you're doing.
They really try. And I'm not going to speak too, general, like some of my brothers will get it more than others. And that's okay with me. I kind of like the range of engagement, I guess, because I can have a conversation about my work with all my brothers, and some in a deeper way and some in a more shallow way. And that gets me still talking about it. And I like that.
It makes me wonder if any of your brothers are having the thoughts of whether you get them. Or are you, yeah, as the creative artist in the family, the one who's sort of like taken on the role of you said peacekeeper, and I would say like empath, right? Where you're thinking about how to make these connections, right? Yeah. And wondering how to meet them where they are.
Yeah.
You know, are they, how do they, well, I don't want to rope four people into one personality, but that, like,
yeah,
if you choose one of your brothers and just maybe talk about how they relate to your work and how they perceive their own presence in it, right? Because that's a big part of your work is autobiographical.
Yeah. So what
is that too big a question?
Yeah. What is the question?
Well,
there?
Before we started this three-way conversation, Joshua and I were talking a little bit about one of his brothers who he lives with,
mm-hmm.
right? So like, for example, someone who has exposure to your practice a little bit and your day-to-day life, right? How would, if you don't mind talking about it, how would he talk about the way he connects with you?
I think because that he is, we have a room for him and he's staying with us, he does really try to engage in that.
Mm-hmm.
While keeping a distance, just so we don't go insane. And, you know, having roommates in general, you know, can create some tension with weird sleep deprivation, new kids.
Yeah. I get it.
And so, no, he's really good. He will come out and sit with me and just hang out, and I like that, and that's fine. And other times, and he's really engaged with what he does. And
yeah,
I mean, they're all really supportive, whether they understand it or not. And that's what I've always appreciated. We all reciprocate, and so there's, yeah.
Cool. Yeah. And, you also mentioned when we were chatting earlier that your studio is at home.
Yeah, that's a new thing this year. I have a detached garage, and mm-hmm. I like drywalled the whole thing, put up lights, and kind of made it my space. And that's been interesting because having a 2-year-old that will see me through the window and want to come out and paint with me, and which I love, and it's distracting at times. We've had to like renegotiate studio hours when he's like down for a nap or when he's at bed at night, just so we just avoid the whole confrontation of him grabbing a paintbrush, because he like can now push chairs and like grab things and like will attack a painting. And sometimes I keep the marks. but yeah, like that's been difficult. That's difficult to have that close proximity.
Uh-huh.
I think I did enjoy like having to like get in my car or get on my bike and go to the studio and have that be a place where I can work and not have that distraction. But sometimes the healthy distraction is okay.
Yeah. And sometimes you keep the marks.
Sometimes I keep the marks.
Yeah. I think that's a really interesting dividing line between, you know, what actually is a healthy distraction. If, you know, if you're out there and your kid's out there, I mean, I suppose you could, it sounds like you have a very open and accepting attitude about it, but I could see how that could take you out of your thought process pretty quickly.
Absolutely. I've destroyed some pieces because of it, and which is not fun. I hate it. But I think that some good things come from those times, because I do make work that engages my relationships with family. So I just see it as I'm a silver linings guy. So like if something bad happens, I will try to find, okay, well, this was a good experience. You know, the fact that my kid is now like painting on like large canvases and having fun with that. I mean, I don't destroy too many pieces with him around. We've gotten that balance mm-hmm. pretty well controlled. But at the same time, like when something like that happens, I try to like see the good in that situation, and then I'll take a break and then I'll go back at it and then solve the problem all over again. Or now there's a new problem that I get to work with. And that's fun. I enjoy that part.
Right.
That's flexibility and, and resiliency, right, in your practice, which are like huge assets for a parent,
yeah, right,
to be
yeah.
able to like roll with it and adapt.
Yeah,
I struggle with that sometimes.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's mm-hmm. that's it's this girl and now with two, it's like I'm having to learn how to do it all over again, mm-hmm. and or just or continue to grow into that flexibility. But I mean, I think that, that I've been that way for a long time, is just being flexible. When we're all like growing up, when we were like going out to dinner as a family, I never cared where we went. I was like, do I get food? Awesome. Like, let's go to that place. And you know, I was really just easygoing. I didn't really care. I didn't have those opinions. I did like, I do have certain opinions. Like I just picked what opinions I really, or what, issues I really wanted to like argue about or like assert myself in. But
so are any of, sorry,
I was just going to say, so is all that,
this is fun by the way, because then I was like, oh wow, this is a counseling session.
We're finally getting somewhere. Exactly. It only took about 20 minutes, but, are you leaving all that mental space by being, you know, carefree and open and flexible with everything for your art, so you can finally sort of apply criticality to something?
Yeah, definitely. I think that I just kind of have a good sense of humor about a lot of it, and so when something like that happens, I think it's funny. I think it's or when something like my son comes in and he decides like to just start painting on the walls. I mean, it's a studio. There's paint on the walls anyway. I'm pretty, my reflexes have gotten quicker. So, you know, he starts to beeline for, you know, a piece that is done. And it's like, I need to flip it over, wrap it up. Like, I'm pretty quick. But at the same time, it's just fun to see that, like, have that relationship. I have a good relationship with him. He's in that terrible two stage, though, so...
You probably yeah. need to have like an, when he's out in the studio, an invisible leash, basically, that you're, if you're yeah. actually not yeah. holding him, you sort of, you have to sort of have your mental leash
yeah.
holding him. So as soon as he gets too close to anything.
Yeah. But it's hard to get any work done. And I'm, yeah. I don't want to make it sound like he's with me every time I'm in the studio, because
right.
he's not. My wife and I, we have a really healthy balance of, okay, I watch him. We like every Monday mornings, we get coffee. We talk about her schedule for work. We need to talk about our schedule for our parental roles, like, you know, okay, who's watching Scott this part of the day, and then we kind of just execute that. And then there's times where she would be more busy, like work would be really pressing, and then I'll just take over and then have him in the studio with me. So that's kind of how the balance of powers work in our family.
So Jen, when you have, well, I mean, I'm imagining you're not going to be working with people that are, you know, that are well adjusted and don't really seem to have any apparent issues. But let's just say you did, or we could take this as a case study. Where would you, what sort of angles would you look for to start finding some cracks?
I don't know anyone who's well adjusted.
Now you do.
Well. Okay, sure. But I guess, you know, everyone has a family, right? And in every family, there are problems. And you
yeah.
can you can paint over them, right? You see what I did there?
Yeah, nice.
But they're still there. And yeah. I would say, like, part of what's so interesting to me about your work, having seen just a little bit of it and talked to you for a short time, is that there's a deliberate covering up. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yet you present your family as this wonderful.
Oh, I hope it's not too wonderful. We have tons of problems.
It's not a criticism. It's just like, you know, to look at the way we create contrast and the way we cover and recover things.
Yeah,
right. That's
yeah.
like, that's all I do. Right. So yeah. I guess I would say in any healthy family, there's a history. For any person who presents with no issues, I would say if they talk for long enough, they're going to have questions about themselves. And a lot of the focus in therapy is to help a person know herself or himself more deeply. That doesn't imply there's a problem
yeah.
or an issue to be worked out. But, you know, the parallel maybe is for an artist through his work, he might know himself more deeply, right? Mm-hmm. And grow.
Yeah, I think the subtext maybe of what I was getting at too is that has, as you suggested thus far, provided a image of a family that's very well adjusted, and himself is very well adjusted and relatively, if not completely, without issues, if there is such a thing. The point is that I buy it, and that's why if there are cracks to be found, yeah, I guess you have to talk for a long time to sort of get there. But yeah. Since we don't have
or just
a long
ask,
time,
you can ask yeah. about the cracks,
right?
Or not? No, I mean, I present it because I'm happy with my family, and so I think whenever you're talking about something that you're really happy with, yeah, you're going to talk about like a lot of the positive things. Talk to me when I like just get in an argument with like my brother or my dad or something like that, and the cracks are definitely more evident.
Right. Did you say, I think we were a little unclear earlier, or barely got into it, but so you have one of your brothers is staying with you? What's the situation there?
He is he's coaching a volleyball team in Valencia, and he needed a place to stay for the season. So we had an extra bedroom, and my wife and I talked about it. We're like, well, I mean, we don't live super close to Valencia, but I mean, you can stay with us until you figure things out. And it's kind of one of those things. We've been on the other end of that ourselves. And so we know that we just are just kind of reciprocating. You know, I've had to stay with my in-laws because we didn't know where we were going to be. And so I think just that pain at forward attitude towards my brother, and hopefully like he can figure out where things are going to happen next for him. And yeah, like that's kind of like the mentality going into that. And fortunately, like my wife is a really easygoing person too. We can never decide where we're going to eat because we're like, no, what do you want to go eat? No, you. Yeah. And so
you got your brother to decide for you.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Yeah. My wife is a fantastic cook though. So we often stay at home. We're hermits. We don't get out much. Mm-hmm.
But the dynamic, even though you're straight on it being, you know, the right thing to do, obviously, the dynamic is playing out well.
I mean, at times it's great. Other times it's like clean your dishes or something like that. But that's, my wife does that to me. So it's like, it's just natural things that happen. He travels up to Fresno, see his girlfriend, and so he's gone a lot, and he's here on the weekends, and yeah, it plays out. And the confrontation is really healthy. I believe in communication. I think that's such a strong thing. And my brother that lives in Chicago, like we used to fight all the time. Now he's like one of my best friends. We have confrontation bi-weekly just because we like to talk and talk about things, and but it's all like a really healthy thing. We both acknowledge that and maybe that's like the art background is like being critical and mm-hmm. talking about things and don't like not trying to fluff up our lives more than it needs to be.
Is this the brother who's the lawyer?
No.
Who lives in Chicago?
No. I have a brother that's a preacher in Chicago.
Okay. So yeah. Is he the one you have confrontation with?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
What are the confrontations about?
Well, like growing up, it would be over stupid things. And he's like 6'7". I'm 6 foot. So I'm the short one in my family. And at one point, he used to be able to like beat me up. And I'm like, gosh, like that's like that. And hit me over the back with like putters and things like that.
Whoa.
It was pretty hardcore. And now we're like best friends. So, but conversations like.
So you forgave him?
And yeah, yeah. I mean, I tormented him in other ways. And
so it wasn't unprovoked, these golf sessions?
Totally unprovoked. It's sibling rivalry.
See, there you go. See, everyone's got something.
There you go. I was really trying to find some good cracks, and yeah. But like current issues are more than like communication things. I think a lot of arguments happen because of like communication hasn't been the best, and so he'll misinterpret something, and then we like work on trying to interpret it exactly what I meant.
Mm-hmm.
Things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So.
Let's transition to your teaching at Pepperdine.
Yeah.
So what is Pepperdine's art school or department known for, if anything?
I don't know if it's known for anything particular. I went there. I'm an alumni. It's a small department that the student teacher ratio is really great. Didn't have a ton of people in my class, and had good faculty when I was there. And now the students are really smart, and they have like good hearts, and they are really critical about things, and they are service oriented, which is kind of cool. Like to have a dynamic of students that are like care about others. And
is that part of the school?
I think that's the type of students that get in to uh-huh. Pepperdine. It's a pretty competitive school, and so I know that they care a lot about that. But yeah, it's fun for me to be back there, because you know I think about when I was a student there, and think about all the things that I've learned since then, and how I can relate it onto like the students that go there. I've had some pretty incredible students that have come through my classrooms, and just thinking how fortunate I am to have like wow, you're an incredible person. And yeah, I just keep getting that, and I keep getting blindsided by like these really great people that are going to be fantastic in whatever they're going to be doing with their lives, whether it's, you know, being an artist or not. Cause I teach a lot of GE, so I don't necessarily have just art majors, and I have business majors and foreign Spanish majors and psychology majors and things like that. And so the dialogue that happens in the class is pretty great. They try to enjoy the subject. I try not to blow it. I think I try not to ruin it for them, but yeah, it's pretty great.
How would you ruin it for them?
I don't know.
Isn't that a little surprising that, might that be seen as surprising that Pepperdine is a community service or community oriented school, based on, you know, the general reputation that the school might have over the years?
What reputation?
Well, just, you know, being where it is. And, you know, I think that the type of student that probably went there at least, you know, 15, 20 years or more ago might have been more of a region, you know, a neighborhood type of student and whatnot.
I mean, there's definitely students that come from, I mean, there is a lot of diversity that goes to that school. And yeah, you have the wealth of some of those students is unreal. Like McLaren's will pull up in a student parking lot. But then you have like the opposite end of the spectrum. I think, as far as I know, I'm in the art program. It's like the rejects. And so that's fun for me. I like that. I'm not in the, you know, maybe the business department's a little bit different. I don't know.
But you are getting general education students too, you said, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I have a question. McLaren, are you talking about the stroller?
No, the car.
I don't know what
the
that
car.
Is.
It's a nice car. There's like okay. Lamborghini, okay. Ferrari. Gotcha. Those are in the parking lot too.
Good question.
That yeah. But that's a parent question, you know, like... Yeah. The people who can afford to buy expensive strollers,
yeah.
are
they will grow up to be able to buy a very expensive stroller.
Gotcha. Yeah. So there's a parallel there.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, but it sounds like you work well with the students generally, because you generally are getting the non-conformist part of the school.
Some. There are some that are so conformist, it's hilarious. I would say it's more comical than anything. But, I mean, you know, you can't say, like, one group of people are this way, or one school is this type of student. And trying to generalize the type of student that goes to Pepperdine or, you know, somewhere else. It's kind of, I mean, it's hard for me to do it, but I know that in like the students that I've had so far, I've had some terrible ones, like bad students, but that's, I mean, I get to teach like the really good ones too, that are more memorable to work with, and that keep me wanting to engage the students. And I think that's the fun part.
You know? Sounds like you're saying that the good students outweigh in your memory than the bad students. Is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Which is a really great skill. I mean, yeah. I think that goes a counter to what most people do, because when you have that really difficult student, you know, that just makes your life hell, you know, to some degree, it's hard to erase that from your memory.
It is, and I still remember them pretty vividly. But, you know, you get a couple of classes that are just like phenomenal students, and you're like, oh, that bad student was like a few semesters ago. Like the present is so much. I guess it might be a good segue into the reason why I paint over. Well, not the reason why I paint over photographs, but anyway, I like the present so much better than dealing with like past and past events. So whenever I have a good semester of students, and there, you know, there's a couple of bad ones, but they're still like, the present is so great, and I don't really care about like the terrible students that I've had in the past, because I'm really enjoying it now. You know, previous semesters, I've also had incredible students that I will never forget, and that's also great too. But I wouldn't say I'm like the most nostalgic person, and maybe that's why I care really what's happening in the present. And maybe that's one of the reasons why I started painting over family photographs. I used to paint over magazine ads just for kind of fun, as like a sketchbook to kind of see what forms I can make over, you know, pre-existing like cars and stuff like that. And I didn't care about that. I didn't care about what was on the ad or anything like that. It's not important to me. So I wanted to make it more personal. So I said, well, I'm drawing over my face is pretty personal. But also like my family, when I was a student at Claremont, like I read this book of, it's like, what do images want? And that was an interesting book. I don't remember a lot of it, but there was one specific part that stuck out to me, and it was, and I think the author's, W.J.T. Mitchell. And he pulls up this analogy where it's like, would you take a photo of your mom and poke her eyes out? Well, if you have a good relationship with your mom, like typically you wouldn't. But I was like, well, I have a great relationship with my mom. What if, you know, and then that was like, well, I'm going to do it anyway, and not poke her eyes out, but like paint over her face and see like how I can develop, like how I can deny that while moving forward with a, like an image. And so I think that kind of relates with how I'm like really more in the present, and how I love the past and it's great, but I'm not nostalgic. I wouldn't call myself the most nostalgic person.
Yeah. You sound pretty unnostalgic.
Mm-hmm. I paint over old paintings all the time.
Does the painting over family photos, up to the present, or is that something that you stopped doing at some point?
It's up to the present. I'm still investigating it, and I started a couple years ago, and it started with the whole like power of image. You know, but ultimately once you did like just paint over something and then that person loves the fact that you painted over their face, like you realize that there's other things that are going on than just, you know, talking about the power of, I think is What Do Pictures Want is the name of the book. Yeah.
The photos you paint over are not originals. Is that right?
Some are not.
Okay. So you're painting over the photo that was taken, and it's like the, I don't know how to say
the original.
The original.
Yeah, the original. So like, for example, if you went and dug through an old closet and found photos of yourself, mm-hmm. as a 3-year-old, right? You're 30 something?
30, yeah.
Right. So like, we're going back to a time when photos weren't instantly reproducible in a home, right? Yeah, for most people. So if you found that photograph, would you use it in an anti-nostalgic way and effectively destroy it, right?
So the funny story is when I started doing this, I love having a sense of humor with my parents, and like I took their engagement photo off the wall and I painted over it. And not the original, I scanned it. But when I presented it, like I made it look like it was the original, and just to freak them out, and I assured them that it wasn't, but it was stuff
like
that.
But there
was
a moment
funny.
Where they thought it was.
Yeah, yeah. That was the beginning. And then I scan everything just to save it, and sometimes the quality of the original is really great, and I'll paint over that, and then I'll just reprint it on a, you know, reprint it by the 4x6 or whatever size it was in. And
was that the first family photo you painted over?
I was working on about 4 or 5 pretty iconic images that I can remember growing up. My mom had like the salon style family wall or family photos on the wall. And I was working on the magazine pieces, and I went home and I was like, my mom still has a prom picture of like a previous girlfriend, and I'm married now with like, you know, with a kid on the way. And I was like, this is really funny. And so that was like, just thinking of that, it made me want to like start pursuing what that was. And so then I started painting, like I took about 4 or 5 off the wall, and there was like the blank spots of where, you know, you can see the dust around the empty space of where the frame used to be. And that started it. And then it became, I just kept doing it. And it was like, some were pretty charged images that I found.
Like what?
I got ran over. Here's a bombshell. Here's a good crack. I got ran over by a car when I was 5. My dad did it on accident. And there's an image that I found of me after after coming home from the hospital, where I had like balloons and a stuffed animal, and I had like this really like sad look on my face. My nose is terrible. It's so scary. And so like when I'm working on that, that was really charged for me, and I can paint it over and I still see, like, I still know what's there. You can't forget it. And so that was an interesting piece. The piece was terrible, but the just the act of doing that was pretty difficult.
Mm-hmm. Why was it terrible?
The seeing my face, I can still remember it. I was 5 and I can still remember it pretty vividly. My dad can too, as you can imagine. Mm-hmm. And it was one of those freak accidents that, my parents took 2 separate cars to a soccer tournament. And you know, my brothers got in one van and my dad was by himself, and you know, I was like, oh, I want to go with my dad. No one's going with him. I kicked the ball under the car and I went to get it. And when I was trying to get out, the car had started and backing up, and my face got caught between the asphalt and the front right passenger, or the front passenger tire. And I remember a bald man with khaki pants picked me up, bled all over his pants. My dad picked me up, got in the van, went to the hospital, woke up. And I don't remember anything after that. And then I remember like going home that, like, whether it's that night, I don't remember that part. So pretty vividly, I can think about it. I've revisited the parking lot when I was traveling in North Carolina, because we were living there at the time. And I like was pretty emotional about it. And my dad talking about it at my rehearsal dinner right before I got married. It was the first time I've ever heard him talk about it. Got really emotional about it. And so I think a lot of those charged memories, it was hard to cover up I'm totally going on a tangent here.
Keep it coming.
So painting over that one is, I think, the only image I have had difficulty with. Everything else, I don't care. Like, it's fun. And I blow them up too. Like, I'll make them really large. When my brother's making a funny face, or my mom like was closing her eyes or something like that. And you can like, accentuate it to 3 feet tall. I find that entertaining and funny, and I enjoy that part of it. And then occasionally I'll get like a good image that was like, I'll see that and I'm like, oh, this is gonna be fun to, this is gonna be interesting, like marking over. Yeah.
I don't know if I misinterpreted you. You said, did you say the piece was terrible or that the process,
the final piece was terrible? I mean, I ruin more photographs than I keep because there's a fine, delicate balance between interacting with photography and imposing painting on.
Uh-huh.
And I want that balance. I don't want abstract painting to overtake photography and kind of miscommunicate with the image. And so sometimes I just obliterate the image and it's just painting talking with painting. And that's not interesting to me. I like dealing with those conditions of the photograph, and I respond to that. And so that piece specifically just didn't turn out. But that process was fascinating, and I haven't revisited it since.
Mm. This is totally interesting to me because I wonder if part of the work is about destruction.
I think there is a part that is destruction. I would say immediately comes reconstruction, because I think that has a lot of value, with what I'm investigating.
Yeah. And I think, I'm kind of like separating it, right? So the piece that you paint over and keep as a work, as a finished work, that's one kind of destruction or reconstruction. The piece that you say it's terrible and you never show it,
that's destruction.
That's destruction. But in a, if we say anti-nostalgic, there's a different word for it. It's almost like I'm not keeping this piece of before. It's just gone.
Yeah. Because I feel like that, like being anti-nostalgic is pretty negative, and I can paint it in a very negative way. And I think when you look at my pieces, it doesn't, and I try for this, but I try not to make it look like full of hate or anything like that. I don't like the hostile look of painting over like my family. And that's something that I'm interested in altogether. You know, if you have like even scratchy looking lines or gestures, that reads totally different than something that's like, I don't know, more heroic gestures that are draping over a figure. Like those read totally different. Mm-hmm. And so I'm learning like how that is perceived, like how I perceive it.
So the feeling in the marks, in the gesture.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because the photos have feeling, the photo will have a mood to it already, and it's innate. And anytime that you scratch out a face or cover a face, like it can easily present itself to being hostile. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we would be talking probably like more in your office hours of why I'm painting over faces. But I try to make it less about that and more just this simple conversation between the photograph and the painting, and merging the two and marrying the two together with all the other things that are coming with it. Like I do get to experience like a lot of the things that come along with photography, and it's great. It's my appreciation to photography is like a lot more than it used to be. And to painting. I've always loved painting. I've been an abstract painter for a while, but I wanted to kind of stretch it somewhere else. And I kind of like the idea. My old paintings had this photographic presence to it. Like there was like sharp gestures over very soft gestures. And so the depth of field would be messed with in painting. And so I thought a logical next step was to like see how photography would inform the painting, or how the painting would inform photography. And so I've been kind of exploring that ever since. You know, I'll flip a photo upside down because that's such an abstract painting thing to do. But then I would like create a highlight in this gloppy, you know, mark. And so creating like light and dark in an abstract painting seems to be very appropriate. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I was just going to ask, aside from all the traditional art making decisions that you're describing, you know, in that general angle of it, do you get catharsis from painting over the more personal images on some level, do you think?
What do you mean?
Catharsis, you know, some satisfaction or letting go or destruction or something along those lines.
At times, it's like as certain images come, like covering up, maybe like if I'm having a terrible relationship with my brother or like we just got an argument, sometimes those images become very like, you know, hostile.
So it is an emotional thing. It's,
at times,
it's
yeah,
like tapping
yeah.
into that, some of those abstract expressionist cliches of like shitting on your, you know, whoever the piece is about.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, at times. There's a memory that I have of, with my brother that's in Chicago. We used to get in fights, and sometimes my way of handling aggression would be me drawing a picture of me like beating him up. And it was like my non-confrontational way of dealing with it. And so in some ways, like maybe that comes out. Not frequently. It doesn't happen frequently, but yeah, occasionally it happens. And but as of late, there's and this is something I'm really excited about, is the work is transforming, and the people that I paint over, there's a sense of like ownership or pride that goes into it. And I kind of enjoy that.
Wait, who's ownership or pride?
Whoever
theirs
it is that
or...
I'm painting over, they're like, oh, where's the painting now?
So they know that you're doing it.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. You do it long enough, and then it'd be that power of like that kind of humor changes into something that is affection. And I'll realize like, oh, I've been painting over like these three brothers and not, you know, this brother. And I'm like, oh, but my brothers really like it when I do paint over them. So I probably should, you know, and sometimes that like plays into decisions and
peacekeeping.
The peacekeeping, which is kind of funny because it started off being somewhere like someplace that is completely different.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings it to this community thing too. Like, well, it doesn't necessarily have to be with my brothers. Now I'm like thinking of people who I'm engaging with like currently and like my life now, and thinking about branching out beyond my family, essentially.
Are you painting or have you painted over your children?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Some good paintings have come over my kids.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And then when they get to confront that, like they have a really unique position of seeing the images before I paint them. And I print them, to be pretty large. I like to paint large. I think if anything, like if I can make something life size or even larger, or a face that's looks like a giant, it's kind of, that's fun for me. But when my kid will see him in a big painting, it's pretty fun. So, and then they see me paint over it, and I don't think I don't know if they understand, like, I don't think they read into it. I think they just see that I'm painting over something, and maybe it's the same thing if they were to paint over a wall. I mean, they color in color, like books and things
but
like that.
But there's like a permissiveness in it that kids whose dads aren't painting over photographs don't have, you know, like
yeah.
In a typical family home, if a kid goes up to a framed photo on the wall and paints on it or draws on it with a crayon,
yeah.
A parent is going to say, hey, don't do that.
Oh,
you know,
man.
We
like
draw on
the
paper,
in
right?
In daycare, he's going to be painting in the books.
Right.
I'm in so much trouble.
We were driving one day outside and my daughter, she was probably about two when it happened, she saw some graffiti and she pointed it out and said, somebody wasn't listening. You know, because
wow,
she recognized
yeah.
like someone
yeah.
drew on the wall, and
yeah.
we've had to tell her like a billion times, you know, you can't draw on the walls in here. So we always have paper, but of course she doesn't want the paper. So like, I imagine those rules are a little different in your home.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have books. I don't want them to draw on my books. And we have like designated places for him to destroy or
mm-hmm.
make stuff. And then again, he's 2.5 and I'm probably going to be getting in trouble a whole
yeah.
lot more, you know, in the next
Well, the designated places like solve half the battle.
Yeah.
Right. Because
yeah.
sometimes they're cool with it and that's the compromise, and other times they're like, I'm still gonna draw on the wall.
Yeah, yeah. Oh man, and we're renting a place. I hope our my landlord doesn't listen to this.
I think the odds are 0%.
Okay, good. Yeah, like he just like will take the marker down the wall, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I know how to fix that, so I'm not super worried. Yeah, but so we're working on that. He definitely wants to be outside the box, and as much as I want him to be in the box, I also want him to be out of the box.
So, Josh, I hear that you have a show in New York coming up. Is that correct?
I do. It's looking like it's going to be May. Still trying to confirm the dates. But, yeah, I'm working. We're going to have a show at Freight and Volume. So,
Where are they?
They're in Chelsea. So the show is... I'm excited about it. The work that's going into the show is... It seems like it took a turn into an interesting direction, and
how did that come about?
So I work with Mark Moore Gallery, and they have a good relationship with them, and it kind of happened organically. Nick liked one of my pieces at one of the fairs, and that kind of
right. That was a fair discovery.
It was a fair discovery. Yeah, yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm trying to think of something, anything else, with me painting over some charged images. But I'm loving the blowing things up to larger, because we disregard a lot of these photos, like the printed photos. Like my mom has boxes of them and just doesn't want to deal with them. I'm like, I'll take them off your hands. And so that's been pretty interesting. That whole if I've spent the money to blow it up or something like that, or take something that's been disregarded to blow up, that's like me cherishing something and then I paint over it. But I see now me painting over something is more of like a celebratory act. It's like there's a show on MTV when I was a kid called Pimp My Ride. I'm from Fresno, and there's a lot of pimping of rides that go on there. And so in some ways I see this as me doing that to the photos and, living out my, I didn't have a low rider. I actually had a lifted truck at one point in time. So do not judge.
Peer pressure.
Do not judge. It was an awesome car. It was a 67 Ford Bronco. And that was lifted, and it was a really awesome car. I loved it.
Was that just the culture that everybody did took part in that?
Yeah, the culture, four wheeling, mud bogging, going in the sand dunes.
What was
mud bogging?
What's mud bogging?
Mud bogging is when you drive in the mud, and deep mud, where you have to use four wheel drive, or if you're cocky, you don't have to. And that was part of high school. It's a transformation of American graffiti,
So that's not a new thing. That's
No, it's you should Google it. It's highly Google entertaining. It. It's highly entertaining.
Along yeah, I used to four. McLaren I used to four wheel. Do you mud bog in a McLaren? You wouldn't do that.
No, you wouldn't do that.
No.
Although, if you have enough money, you can try it out, but I wouldn't recommend it. Yeah, that culture was really just bizarre. My wife is from Thousand Oaks, and so. Her connotation to a lifted truck is way different from what my views were on a lifted truck. I used to think that they're very practical. You can go in the mud and snow and sand and parking lots in Fresno can support it because they're huge and
right.
Parking stalls are gigantic. And I've been here for over 10 years and it's the last thing I want is a lifted four wheel drive car. Mm-hmm. I'm practical now. I was I get a minivan. You can haul paintings and kids at the same time. So
was your lift high enough so that you actually had to sort of hoist yourself to get onto that first step? Or was it not that crazy?
Like a horse?
Yeah.
It wasn't that crazy. Yeah. Although I knew a lot of friends that had crazy, crazy lifted trucks. But it was too crazy. Wouldn't do that. It was pretty funny. It's so impractical. A little stepladder that you would fold down.
So now instead of tricking out vehicles, you're tricking out family photographs.
Yeah. Family photographs.
Way to put a bow on it, Jen.
I love it. Yeah.
Josh, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome to the fold. Thank you. And
we're out.
That was fast.
Thanks very much again to Joshua Dildine for being our guest today. And yeah, I think now that you've heard it, you can probably, and I'll help you out a little bit. There's some things alluded to but not said along the way that might give you more of an indication of some of the things that are going on. Joshua is a very good diplomat, and one can learn a lot from his diplomacy style. And again, the website for the show is theconversationpod.com. There are many ways you can support the show. I have received a few donations post the 100th episode. I would love to have several more. So if you have not contributed yet, I invite you to do so via the website. Of course, you can also support the show numerous other ways, social media-wise. We've got the Instagram, we've got the Twitter, we've, of course, got the Facebook. Become a fan there, all of those places. And here's the other thing that I have been saying for a couple episodes now. If you are not a subscriber already on iTunes, whether you use this show on iTunes or not, if you go to iTunes, find The Conversation under The Conversation, An Artist Podcast, subscribe, and then you can immediately unsubscribe if you're not interested in remaining subscribed. And apparently, I heard this from another podcaster, just subscribing, even if temporarily, helps with the metrics for your podcast, in this case, The Conversation. So grab your phone, grab your friend's phone, go online and subscribe via iTunes. And that will help bring more people to the show and give us better numbers in the eyes of the iTunes God who rules all. So that would be much appreciated. What else do I have to tell you? Another episode coming up next Saturday. Stay tuned. Another young Angelino. Thank you very much for being here. I appreciate your listening and your support. And I will talk to you soon. Ciao for now.